I'm Charles Clover, Executive Director of the Blue Marine Foundation at the Extreme Hangout in Glasgow.
Well, welcome. And here we are amongst the midst. I guess it's the midline point, the day when people pause for breath at COP26. But of course, you were there at COP1. Was it the Rio Earth Summit?
That was something. That had taken 2 years of campaigning to get a climate treaty together. It was announced then. The biodiversity treaty was announced then too, and the Americans immediately decided that they weren't going to sign it. So the climate treaty has always been a little bit ahead of the biodiversity treaty, and that's sort of coming home to roost in the absence of the oceans from this treaty even now.
I mean, the oceans are so much a significant part of this, so much a victim of this. It's surprising that they get so little or disproportionate attention.
It's all about science. It's just the things that we know the ocean does are so hard to count and to study that, you know, the contribution that whales make to fertilizing the ocean is only just beginning to come out in the last week. The contribution that fish make to fertilizing the ocean, that large predator fish have to keeping carbon in the ocean where it ought to be, is not even researched yet. And how much carbon there is on the seabed, we're only beginning to look at. And what we have been doing to disturb that carbon, put it back into the atmosphere, has only really been talked about this year, 30 years in. To a climate treaty. That's pretty astonishing. We've always known that the ocean was 40 or 50% of the carbon absorption on the planet. It takes up, you know, half roughly of all the emissions that we produce and deals with them in mysterious ways. But it's just been too complicated until now to actually work out how that the ocean did it. As we now begin to work out how, there are so many ways in which we could assist the ocean to do more of it. Mm. And they're quite big things.
I mean, how frustrating is it that it's been such a long journey? I guess it's mixed emotions in some respects for what's finally coming out.
Well, I think the first 15 years of it were people denying that we needed to do anything at all. I think now, as Al Gore was saying yesterday, quoting Winston Churchill, the time of equivocation, half measures, is over, and this is a time of consequences that everyone can see. So there is a great willingness to do something, often from companies who don't really know what to do, because it's not wildly clear how to engineer these nature-based solutions, which are going to be, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40% of what we can do to mitigate the impact of climate change and hold us down to 1.5 degrees. And we haven't even started. A lot of the stuff that you can do with soils, peat bogs, and on forests on land is only really starting. The stuff we can do with the coastal margins, with seagrass, mangroves, salt marsh, is at almost an experimental level. And nobody has done anything about the seabed, the continental shelves. So there's a lot of work to do and very little time, but the process would have been faster if people had actually believed the science in the beginning, because they were told, but vast industrial and commercial juggernauts take a long time to turn round, and that's really been the story of the last 30 years. Now they have turned round. The question is whether we've actually got the solutions for the enormous amounts of money that they have to be spent on.
You mentioned Al Gore. I asked him whether the truth was still inconvenient, and he said for some it is. Is that part of the problem?
It is part of the problem, and it's particularly relevant to oceans, because people still can't get this thing, which is that nature can help us to solve the climate problem, which will save us. They can't get that because they're trying to do something about carbon or they're trying to do something about biodiversity, these government officials. They cannot yet put the two together. And you need to do that in the ocean because marine protected areas, marine reserves, are part of the key to keeping carbon in the ocean. And these two treaties just don't talk to each other. And, you know, our own government in the UK has all sorts of science programs on carbon and none on the carbon in the sea. And it has biodiversity reasons for doing things like creating marine reserves, though marine reserves in this country are almost entirely unprotected and are paper parks. And it can't put these two together and say, we're going to do this because of carbon and because of biodiversity. They just can't get their minds around it. I don't understand why, but that's the next problem. That's the problem we've got to deal with here and now, from here on.
I mean, as you're introducing the panel going on at the moment, you know, you've been at this 30 years, you're talking about, you know, this generation taking on this and that you've got another maybe 30, 40 years to do this. How hopeful are you that, you know, I know we have to get it right, but that we will. But, you know, there again, we're going to have to suffer the consequences one way or another before we can have some sort of, I don't know, moderation of climate change.
Well, one can only be hopeful about the things that one can alter personally. And that has, I think, been a lot of the problem about the atmosphere side of climate change, because as an individual, one feels so powerless. Funnily enough, we are much less powerless in the sea because each country can do something itself, which is a contribution and which also improves biodiversity. So if we actually protected our huge offshore marine reserve estate in Britain, if we protected it properly, it would start growing, regrowing the forests of the sea that have been trawled to bits for 150 years. And who knows how much carbon that would soak up, but we know it would soak up some. There are other activities, so I mustn't just pick on fishing, but fishing is the most ubiquitous activity in the sea, and some forms of it are putting carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere, and we should just stop doing those. And it's really simple, and it's just changing technology. But, you know, there's also, you know, a huge ideological problem, particularly we're sitting here in Glasgow in Scotland, where the governing party is allied with trawling interests, industrial trawling interests, and just doesn't get it. You know, it's worked out, to its great credit, what carbon it's got in around the Scottish coast, but it is doing nothing about it.
And your own organisation has been busy this week. Tell us what they've been doing and what they've been putting together.
Well, we have just signed a partnership with a big insurance company called Convex, who are very visionary about the oceans. They have undertaken to put some many millions of dollars into researching the carbon sequestrated by the seabed and by the organisms that live on it and swim above it. And this is an order of magnitude more than the British government has so far spent on this. And so we have to admire their courage and their timeliness and thank them very much for it. And this is an example of the kind of pledges by corporations who are really taking climate change seriously that have been going on in the last week. But this is one of the biggest. And Zach Goldsmith paid tribute to our chief scientist, chief scientific advisor, Professor Callum Roberts, who will be in charge of this five-year program, by saying he was an extraordinary character and a wonderful campaigner for the oceans. And he will be taking this on. And we are overjoyed to get that money into this leading edge science.
Fantastic. You just reminded me, yesterday I was at a session and a guy from the IMF was talking about, now we know, now we have a value, we put a value on carbon, and we know how much carbon sequestration can go on in various things, be it whales or whatever it might be. In theory, they could therefore release funds related to that value to help nations protect it and to nurture it. Would that be a welcome development?
I think there's a great deal of scarediness in the bureaucratic mind about unleashing carbon trading using ocean nature-based solutions, because they fear that this will be what they call hot air, that this will enable the oil majors to go on polluting for another century, because they've all bought fraudulent climate offsets. That's their fear, and it's my fear too. We don't want to do anything that is not completely counted and accounted for. But if you can harness the carbon trading systems that will be developed assuredly to protect the ocean and natural systems in the ocean, and particularly in poorer countries who have a lot of them, you know, why not? Mm-hmm. So we've got to get their minds round this one. Obviously, we've got to, you know, apply the same accountancy processes and honest accounting to it as everything else. But it seems to me to be an enormous mistake not to do it.
Mm. I guess it's avoiding, if you like, providing a status quo for continuing pollution and ensuring that rather than net zero, we're going to for an absolute zero. Because as one scientist put it to me, net zero is when we stop making things worse. We've got to actually make things better.
There's a lot of restoration to be done in the sea. If you look at the coasts around our shores, they've been trawled and messed about and polluted for, well, since the industrial period at the very least, and you know, in terms of fishing before that. So there's a lot of restoration to be done, as well as a lot of do no harm. All of that needs to be done now if we're going to stop the world warming.
If you were writing an article at the end of this COP, what would you be filing, do you think?
Well, we'll have to wait for the result, but I think that there is a result before the political result, which is about energy, about the engagement of so many parts of society to actually do something about climate change now, the realization that it's totally real, utterly scary, and that we have to change our lives. And if it means pushing over some of the dinosaur industries that we have around us and doing something else, then what's the problem? Because all the research shows that Nick Stern and others have been doing shows that green industries produce four times the amount of jobs as the old fossil fuel ones. So there's nothing to lose but our chains, really.
So is the call that we've heard from Greta Thunberg and others that it's business as usual and the corporates being given mechanisms to continue business as usual? Is it as cynical as that?
This is her greenwashing allegation, which I think she should make and may be true of some corporates. But I was in a very interesting meeting of 100 CEOs, UK CEOs yesterday, and they're all desperately pledging to do something about climate change. They are honestly looking for ways to spend very large amounts of money on this, and there aren't always the ways. But I think that there is an immense willingness, particularly at these high points, these peaks of public interest. I think nobody dares say we can't do this anymore. The fossil fuel majors are not saying that. They're silent. And they're probably irrelevant now. So that's the thing that's happened in 30 years. They are looking for different business models. That's what's happened. Initially, they spent 20 years trying not to, and now they are. But they don't have the solutions. We must help them to have the solutions. But I'm optimistic because I see the willingness. And I also think some of the low-hanging fruit in terms of marine conservation, marine carbon mitigation, are at hand. We could just do them. They will cost us nothing.
We've got a week to go at COP26. Do you think they can pull it out of the hat, so to speak? I mean, they're only like a third, got commitments for about a third of the CO2 that needs to be taken out of processes so far. You know, what's your gut feel about whether this can, COP26 can be the turning point everybody wants it to be?
Well, I think it will be a great turning point, because it so far has been a very successful conference. And so lots of civil society messages have been pounding in to the ministers saying, do something now. And that's very important. The other thing that's very important around this political process is the degree of pledging by major corporations to do stuff about this now. That's all new. It's massive and new. The amounts of money being talked about are eye-watering in that room, in that huge conference center. So around and about it, there are these messages that occasionally feed back into the process, and I hope will energize and produce a result that was as good as Paris and not like Copenhagen, which I was at and was a total disaster. And I could tell it was a disaster 2 days before it was over. And I wrote the column for the Sunday Times saying, "This, geez, what a way to run a planet," 2 days before they finally admitted that they'd screwed up. So it was a slow motion disaster. And this one isn't a slow motion disaster yet. I can't spot the signs of it being a disaster. So I think we will come out of this with something, and then there will be a COP 27, and that's the way the world works. Mm. It's this, you know, the first attempts at some kind of global governance, and it's a slow process. Mm. But if you've got a third of the if you've got a third of the carbon accounted for, that's a result. It would be nice if it was 100%. But it's better than naught.
So I guess, to coin your description of Copenhagen, this could be a slow motion success.
Yeah, I think it could. I honestly think it could, and I hope it will be.
Fantastic. That's great. Well, thanks for talking to us today, and great success with continuing the fight.
Thank you. And you know, good luck to the young. I've been at this for 30 years. Somebody else is going to have to take this over from me and carry on. So my thoughts are with those younger than me who've got to have a lot of stamina.
Thanks very much, Sean. I think there's plenty of them here at the Extreme Hangout.